Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. It's now part of the Frequency Podcast Network. That's pretty cool. My guest this week is Sheila McLeod, an actor with a long, rich list of screen credits ranging from Dennis Potter's Cream in My Coffee to The A-Team and the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, and runs on Wish Me Luck, Peak Practice, The Bill, Holby City, and Doctors. She recently appeared in Carolyn Saunders' psychological horror drama The Wasting, and she makes her feature directorial debut with Astronaut, a gentle drama starring Richard Dreyfuss as a widowed engineer who enters a contest for a ticket into space. It's on screens in Vancouver and Toronto right now, and available for rental and purchase on iTunes and Google Play, and you should give it a shot. Sheila picked Moon, Duncan Jones' 2009 debut, starring Sam Rockwell as a lonely technician nearing the end of a 3-year stint on an isolated lunar base and looking forward to the trip back to Earth, only to find himself questioning everything when a minor accident leads to the arrival of a new worker and a shocking revelation. Well, one of several, really. We're obviously going to get into major spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film, please stop now and go do that. Are you back? Great. Let's get into it. This is Someone Else's Movie.
I love the genre because I think it's kind of like, we call it in England near-fi, so it's kind of sci-fi, but it's also a very human story. Mm-hmm. So it's not spaceships shooting at each other and mad dashes through the universe. It's a recognisable world almost, although it's set on the moon. And I love it because it's a human story, but it's about identity. And there's such a sort of sorrowful, melancholic tone in the film, in Moon, that I'm drawn to as a new writer and a new director, because, you know, I've just directed my first feature film, Astronaut. And when I first saw it, I was just blown away. I was blown away by the design. The tone was so perfect. The grade was brilliant. The performances, Sam Rockwell was astonishing.
Performances plural is almost a bit of a stretch, really. It is a one-man show.
He's always been one of my favourite actors. I mean, I'm a bit obsessed with Sam Rockwell as an actor myself. There's something about him as an actor that just, he's got the star thing going on, but he's also got that everyday actor quality to him where he does really transform. So he doesn't play one part again and again. He plays off himself again and again. Mm. But he manages to transform into another character. And there was such plight in the story. It had the ticking clock, which was great, you know. It had this incredible twist in the middle, which I wasn't expecting. I mean, I don't know how many spoilers I'm allowed to give.
I mean, it's a 10-year-old film, I think.
Well, free. I mean, you know, well, the twist is, you know, of course, when he finds out that he's not the only one, and
he's not the only him.
He's not the only him. And I thought it was such an interesting concept. I'm really interested in clones, in AI. I find it a fascinating, fascinating progress at the moment, too, because AI is coming along and along, and cloning's coming along and along, and I'm not opposed to it. I'm intrigued by it. And it was the sort of loneliness of this character, you know, that he's the brilliance of the script by Nathan Parker, I believe, who fed us all those little clues, and I, as the viewer, probably most other people watched it, were gagging for more. So it was almost like a mystery as well. You were constantly trying to work out who this guy was. You know, he wants to go home. And really, in one line, it's about a story of a man who wants to go home. Yeah. And I really empathise with that, because I think that quest to explore is huge in me, in Richard Dreyfuss. I've just worked with him, the whole space race at the moment. But also the quest to return home is it's a funny old push and pull thing that goes on. And I thought that was beautifully done in the film.
Yeah, and in Moon, you also have the additional loaded metaphor that no one wants him at home. That this person, because he is absolutely a person, is not
wanted on voyage, right? He's supposed to stay there. And the thing that surprised me when I started watching the film the very first time I saw it was the sort of pleasure it takes in the old 70s looking special effects. And those are clearly miniatures. They're almost lovingly rendered. Mm-hmm. You're seeing the type of film that Duncan Jones presumably grew up with, mm-hmm. Silent Running, mm-hmm. and maybe even Logan's Run, things like that, where they imagined a future that was not quite dystopian, but manipulative and stacked against average mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. And that mood just sort of snaps right in, and Rockwell inhabits it perfectly, and there are even some subtle styling choices on his suits and even his haircut, which is totally functional.
Yeah.
Speaks to that sort of broken in future.
Yeah.
Alien was another thing I thought of too. Just the working class space travel stuff.
Yeah.
And then slowly, I think it was maybe a few hours after I left the theater, you start realizing how cruel it all is. Mm-hmm. How I started wondering, you know, is the videotape of the family even real? Is any of this real? This is all just, he's a worker bee. He's there to do a job and nothing else. And he's promised endlessly by this corporation in the form of, sadly, Kevin Spacey. Now we have to deal mm-hmm. with that. But this little ambivalent robot voice that speaks to him sort of kindly, but also might just be feeding him lie after lie. Mm-hmm. And the cynicism of it was just so heartbreaking mm-hmm. because I know there's nowhere else this film can go. It has to end where it ends. Mm-hmm. But I really want to know what happens, what's waiting for him, because
when he gets back to Earth. Yeah.
We have no idea how much time has passed. We have no idea if this person even existed, really.
Yeah.
The prime Rockwell.
Yeah. I mean, I like that, though, about the film. I like the fact that I was held in the spell. Mm. And I love the foreshadowing in the film of him burning his hand and turning, and there was this girl sitting in the chair, and you thought, who the hell is she? And the foreshadowing was what to come. And, you know, rewatching it again and again, I just see how brilliantly placed everything is to build up that world. So the world is so, for me, being of a certain age, is very recognisable. I mean, it's very 70s, very, you know, as you say, it's a sort of weird, sombre world and so simple that you think, how on earth would he survive in that? But he does.
Yeah.
And I also loved, you know, going back to the clues and the teases that Nathan Parker and Duncan Jones did so well, is when he's phoning in the report of the day first up, and he gets that interference in the playback, mm-hmm. and he suddenly sees another him,
the glitch,
but doesn't recognize it, and it's a guy with a beard, and Duncan Jones plays with the form a bit, I think. But back to the foreshadowing and the teases that were there, and that wonderful twist when he goes out and he has to, there's something jammed, there's one of the machines is jammed, the harvester's jammed. Mm-hmm. But it's also the way the performances by Sam Rockwell are so different, and yet there's a kind of connection between, obviously it's this, you know, same actor, mm-hmm. and it's a clone playing a clone, you know, but as an actor, again, I look at it and think, how did he do that? Because he must have had a double.
Yeah.
And then just keeping the actual technical side of it, keeping present to remember that character's journey each time, and then stepping to the other character and remembering what his background was and what his history was. And so these little clones who had a 3-year lifespan, I think it's 3 years. Yeah, 3 years. 3 years, buddy, he says. That's what he says. 3 years. It's a long time. Had their individual aspects to their character. And that also made me ask the question, were they evolving themselves naturally? Were they programmed to do that, to have a slightly different personality? Or did the clone start like that and gradually become this guy at the end of 3 years who was tired and worn down and fed up and just wanted to go home?
Yeah.
So it asks all these questions, and sure, it doesn't necessarily give the answer, but I didn't care.
Yeah.
I hate being, you know, for a film like that, to keep to keep those questions up in the air, it really, really worked. I loved it.
Yeah. Oh, there's context provided. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. And that did get me thinking too. It's like, I'm pretty sure if you're going to do something this horrible as a project, it's a Boys from Brazil situation where you would need to sort of plan out all the psychological beats and figure out what information to dangle in order to keep him interested, but not enough that he stops working.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's what I mean. There's somewhere out there, there's a movie about this corporation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's just a horror story.
Yeah. And one day will possibly be true too.
Yeah. Oh,
so,
sure,
you know, like all the great films, you know, they see into the future like magicians and, you know, nothing stranger than art, or art follows, no, the other way around. Yeah. Science follows art, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, the idea too of the motion capture, the motion control rather, being the only real effect, the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a self-contained story. It's got one actor present and then the double, presumably, and also whoever plays people on the video feeds. Mm-hmm. But you can shoot this precisely. It's all sound stages. You can control everything.
Mm-hmm.
As a first feature, it's a really smart move. And then to have a concept that keeps people interested and invested, even when maybe you're spending a little too much time with one person, it's the safeties are built into it, which is great. And then you absolutely have the treasure of Sam Rockwell. There's a moment where he's passive aggressive with himself, which is just my favorite bit of his acting.
Yeah. He goes on a journey and you go with him. So not just within the sort of story world, but he goes on a character journey as well. And it's commenting on himself and his introspection and I just thought it was a superb, superb piece. And the Clint Mansell, fantastic composer. You know, the touch when, I mean, we talked a lot about this when we were making Astronaut, which is a completely different film, of course.
Yeah.
But I said, I made everybody watch Moon, and I said, you have to watch this film and just look at the way, there's a musical refrain all the way through, there's a motif there, but also the genius of Clint Mansell when he discovers he's a clone and they discover where all the clones are. And it's nursery music. It's
really disturbing for how soft and gentle that moment is.
And you know, they're going into the nursery of these clones, and it brings up such a poignant element to the film that you can only feel as a watcher, as an audience. You feel it's like going back into the womb for them, and they see who they are, and they're just a number. They're just a artificial clone in a box, and there are hundreds of them too.
Yeah.
So they were planning to be there for 1,000 years maybe. And
yeah, it's horrible in that perfectly logical way.
Yeah.
In that it is completely understandable that this would happen, and as long as you don't think about the consequences. I was trying to remember when I was planning this episode, just once I got your selections, it was the Foxconn scandal happening around this time. The workers in China who make iPhones and who were killing themselves because they were being worked too hard. And
wow.
The ones who stayed were exposed to, I'm pretty sure there's a chemical poisoning aspect to it as well, mercury or one of the rare earth metals.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just those things that, we're doing this now. Like, we're already in this place where, well, I don't think about where my shrimp came from.
Yeah,
it's probably
sure.
from sure. slavery.
Well, I mean, China has the worst human records.
Yeah, but that the Foxconn thing, the iPhone thing, is the first thing that I thought of. And Moon would have been made the year of the iPhone. And it was shot in 2008 when the iPhone emerged. And
gosh, it was that long ago.
Yeah, and it's completely coincidental because none of that information had come to light. But again, it suits the 70s textures because those films were always about... At the root, it was all about conspiracy and cruelty and corporate and military industrial conspiracy profiteering. And it just feels like it crawled out of that, like it's from its own time warp.
Yeah.
It's emerged in the present.
Yeah. And I love the kind of, you know, the guys that are apparently coming to rescue him with the cheerful voice from England. You've done enough, sir.
Yeah.
You've done enough, Sam Bell. You know, don't worry about it. Well, and it was just brutal.
Yeah.
That, you know, congratulating him on doing a good job, and they were going to finish him off, and he was struggling with the fact that he knew who he was at this point.
And who he wasn't.
And who he wasn't, yeah. And the loss of that life that they had programmed into him, of the wife and the being pregnant with their child, mm-hmm. and, you know, he'd been a bad boy and he was going to be a better husband when he got back. It was just, honestly, just genius. And, the ticking clock was great because he structured it. It's such a beautifully structured film, because suddenly the tension is there and he does the noble thing, the original Sam Bell. And he sacrifices, although he's in such a state at that point. The decay was amazing. The realization of that decay was just, again, brilliant from all departments, you know, from makeup, from every production design, everything, and of the act himself. But, you know, he did the ultimate sacrifice. He sacrificed himself to give his place to the new Sam Bell, to escape.
Right, which could also, or does resonate with the idea of him wanting to be the father he never was. So he's doing that thing where he makes way for the new generation.
Yeah.
And Rockwell, again, this is where it gets tricky because I'm going to have to reference which one he's playing. But the older Sam is rendered as such a... I mean, it's a version of Sam Rockwell we've seen before. He's played injured. He's played wounded emotionally and physically. But he has this way of tossing off pain as an actor that almost... Michael Shannon kind of does it too, but it's just that absolute refusal to engage with it. It's like he's trying to ignore it, but we can see the effort come through.
Yeah, I mean, I think an actress, Judy Dench, does it too. She has this...
Yes.
I think she has this absolute broken quality to her, which she layers with bravado.
Resolve.
And so she's always got that, you know, I hate to say vulnerability, but because, you know, it's a cliche, you know, as a young actor, I was always going, and they said, you know, the brief would always be strong but vulnerable. And you think, well, which should I be when I walk into the room? I don't know, you know, do you want strong or do you want vulnerable? You know, but I get it, you know, because he is strong, but he is vulnerable as well. And so you've got that kind of broken quality hiding underneath, squished down, just peeking through.
Yeah, and because it's Sam Rockwell, he can't not be funny. He always finds a way to put a little...
Which is brilliant, you know, it's brilliant.
The lightness and despair.
It's so easy to be, you know, when you've got a sad scene to you know, over-egg it and play the obvious I can't think of the word, I'm struggling for the word, when we go over the top as actors and emote.
Yes.
We emote too much.
Yeah.
And I've seen myself do it on the screen sometimes. Oh, no, shut up, never do that again. But you learn. And each time you do it, you learn.
Yeah, Streep always said, back in the 80s, I remember, one of the first and most important bits of acting understanding I ever had was that she just said, if you're doing something serious, laugh.
Yeah.
Just reverse it, and it automatically reads as though you're trying to hide it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just makes people lean in a little further.
Yeah.
And Rockwell does it just naturally.
Yeah, he does.
Instinctively.
Yeah.
And he's so good at just whatever the thing is where he is hiding something from his co-stars, but not the camera. He can do that intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
And watching him do it opposite himself, which has to be a special effect. Mm-hmm. There is no way he could have actually played that in real time. It's incredible because... Mm-hmm. His scene partner clearly was gifted enough to give him whatever he needed, but there are just moments where the confusion of new Sam is met with impatience by old Sam, which is just in the moment, instantly. Yeah. The timing on that is incredible.
Yeah, incredible. And so human too, really, isn't it?
And it just makes you relate to this movie that you're watching. You know, somebody else pointed it out. I wish I'd thought of it first, but if you pull back, the entire film is performed by artificial characters.
Yeah.
No one is real.
Mm.
If you accept that the video feeds are pre-recorded or that the voice is an actor, nothing you see is quote unquote human, but it is the most profoundly human experience.
Yeah, because also, you know, it's as we said earlier, it's the character's progression, the development in that 1.5 hours, because it's not a great long movie.
It's very economical.
And it's perfect. The timing is perfect. There is not 1 second wasted in that film. You know, I kind of wanted to go on. I wanted to see, as you say, he wanted to go back to Earth. And did he make it? And did they find a way of saving him so that he could live longer than his... But then I thought, oh gosh, he got back. And they did it so economically. You know, they shut him in that you know, the horrible small capsule, and then you had just the voiceovers saying, you know, this guy says he's from, you know, he's been on the moon, and he's, I believe him, and all that stuff, and you just totally went with it. And I mean, that, you know, the old story, of course, is set the rules, and that will follow. You know, and if you set the rules early on, you can go anywhere with a storyteller because you've set the rules fairly early on.
Yeah, there's one ask, there's one big moment that pushes it, which is just the introduction of the clone, and then everything else, it's logically baked in.
Yeah.
And the other aspect of it, too, is that it isn't a new story.
No.
It's just a very clever, and this is not in any way a shot against the film or an insult to it, it's just, oh, it's Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. It's just the cheapest, most economical version of. We are recording this the day after Rutger Hauer died. His death was revealed, and it's horrible. And people were making jokes on Twitter about how, well, Roy Batty did die in 2019. It's like, no, stop it. No, that's not right. But the idea that we understand in our bones, we understand the narratives of these things. The idea that a limited lifespan character in Sam Bell, not Roy Batty, or not Rutger.
Yeah,
Hauer.
There's a sort of familiarity to it, isn't there? But I think that aids with the story as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's the milieu that's different.
Yeah,
you know, like it's a working class, basic engineering level thing, rather than the gorgeous aestheticized world of Blade Runner, where you know, you linger on lighting and columns and buildings and the shine of a spinner's wheels.
Yeah.
This is really just about what it would be like to live on another part of that world.
Or and then you have a sort of, I mean, not digressing, but you have, you know, Ex Machina, which was such a different, you know, again, it was this much more of an AI world. But again, becoming a human and having this feeling of escape and wanting to be real. And
also limited in its locations too.
Yes, I was just going to bring up. I actually wrote that down because I just said, you know, astronaut is got. We ended up using three main locations, but and we had to originally. The story was huge. You know, there was a whole sequence in space. He was on the ISS. He went for a spacewalk. And there was a cop chase. It was a very different movie. And then I realised that, you know, first-time feature film director, and I don't come like the brilliant Duncan Jones from a commercial background. I come from being in front of the camera for over 30 years. So I have a very different background to approaching making my first film. But I realised that I wasn't going to get $10 million to make this film. It was just not going to happen. And so we drilled down on the budget, and we drilled down on the story too, and we tried to keep distilling the story. And what is this story really about? Well, it's about love, it's about second chances, it's about friendship, and it's about achieving your dreams. And once I got that, I just, okay, this is what I've got to go for. And even I had to have three big locations. So they say, you know, when you're writing, try and set it in one room. You know, and good luck with that one, you know. But they did, you know, it was in one location. It was okay, they had the kitchen in Moon, and they had the basement to go to, and they did have outside, but it wasn't...
You can't spend any time there. It's inhospitable.
Yeah, inhospitable world,
It's fascinating. I understand that in terms of functionality, it just makes sense to make the film as cheaply and easily as possible, but it also makes sense to me that if you're an actor for this long, you're going to look for the emotional hooks rather than the plot beats, and so you would winnow it down to just who these people are and what they're doing. And you know,
I mean, I spent a lot of time at my mom's nursing home, and it was interesting world because it was a lovely nursing home, but it could be very sad place too, because you know, you're on your last journey, right? And it's your last home. But there was sort of humour in it too. But the thing is that the script of Astronaut is sparse because it's quite a quiet place, a retirement home, or we call them nursing homes in England.
Sure.
But there's not a lot of chat. You know, my mum wouldn't engage with anybody. You know, she really didn't want to talk to anybody. She was very depressed. She kept to her room. And that was interesting too, because I, as an actor, on working on some great shows, TV shows, and also some pretty bad ones, you do get your pen and you do cross out your lines and say, we can do it with a look.
Right.
And I trusted, and luckily enough, I have fantastic producers who also trusted me, and together we worked very well as a team, that handing the script over to actors such as Richard Dreyfuss, Graham Greene, Colm Feore, Krista Bridges, Larry Bent, and Richard Lawrence, that they could do so much with very little, you know, with just the kind of intent of what the character felt at the time. And that was quite important to me. So, the next one I do, Nexus, is a much darker piece, and it's a solitary piece, much more of a solitary piece. So it's going to be a challenge to do it. I'll be watching Moon again.
I was going to say that if you've picked a film that you can certainly lift from.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they say steal from the best, don't they? But yeah, there are, and you learn from the best. You know, you learn, how did they do that? And how did he achieve that tone? I mean, flashy camera angles have never really been attractive, unless they mean something. Mm-hmm. If they mean something, it was great. But actually, if you look at the way Moon was shot, it had a sort of steady tone to it, and it had a rhythmic tone. And actually, the film starts with him running on a treadmill, and that rhythmic beat is kind of there.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the wheels of the vehicles.
Yeah, the wheels of represented the vehicle, the pace of the characters, day as he gets through it. He's having his hair cut by the robot. Mm. He's making his breakfast, his tea. It's got a washes, he showers, he sleeps, he wakes up, the clocks. It was all perfectly pitched. The tone was perfectly pitched.
Yeah, it's very circular as well in the addition of a new character and the removal of an old one, and all the themes come back and around again over and over again.
Yeah, life goes on.
Right? Yeah, it's a hamster wheel. I mean, it is a hamster wheel for him.
Yeah.
For a version of Sam.
Yeah, but those moments of horror too, going back to Moon, when he finds... I mean, I think one of the most heartbreaking moments also in the film was when he finds out what they actually have been doing with the clones. They put them in that machine, and I think he finds some dust.
The incinerator, yeah.
And it's an incinerator. And that guy, you know, the effects of the guy saying, well done, now have a good nap, and you're going to be home soon. And it just,
it's monstrous. Yeah, it really is. It's, and it makes sense. That's the worst part.
Yes.
There is nothing in the film that feels unbelievable.
Yeah.
Once they've established the value of the thing that they're mining and the, of course, this is a solution someone would come up with. I mean, I've already expressed my disgust with the imaginary world of it, but it's so well realized. And also bred in our bones from Alien and Silent Running, and just this grand history of 70s sci-fi films where you didn't win.
Yeah,
like Soylent Green doesn't go well for anybody.
And I wonder how hard Duncan Jones, being an acclaimed commercials director at the time, had to fight for that. I mean, you know, I wonder. Getting financed, I believe Trudy Styler was a producer of the film.
I think so. Yeah.
But you know, did he? I'd love to know if he had to fight for his vision, because you do. You know, you have these fights where people are reading your scripts and they're going, "Well, we want a happy ending.
Yeah.
We don't want your character to die. We don't want that." And I remember pitching Astronaut 2 years ago to a producer, and he was great, and he said, "You know, but we like it, but can the dog talk?"
In dreams?
Well, in the end, I was going, yeah, that's a really good idea. So I just thought, oh, God, just give me the money.
Read that and come up with, I don't know which version of the script it would have been, but I don't see a place for
it. It's just, well, I suppose because it's got, it's a fairy tale Astronaut, isn't it? It's a fable, and it's got a little bit of magical realism with a comet. It's got, so I guess the rules could be that the dog could suddenly turn around at all, but... possibly not. Possibly.
I would rather, you need to hold that stuff back. There are certain leaps that films can accommodate.
Yeah.
And here we have a room filled with clones that are in boil bags waiting to be used, and that's fine.
Yeah.
We're accepting that.
Yeah.
I'm rejecting the idea of the dog talking.
No, completely.
It's for the best. But the, we've sort of touched on it already, but the podcast always rolls around to the question of what of your own work has been influence, what have you borrowed or lifted or stolen or quoted from Moon specifically? Is there anything you've incorporated into your own creative DNA?
I think it's influenced me enormously. You know, it's the simplicity, I think, was something that we discussed when we were shooting Astronaut, and I said, this is not a big steady cam piece. This is pretty static and allowing time. I mean, but on the next one, Nexus, I think I will be trying to pilfer as much as I possibly can from that, because it's got that. Nexus is it's about a female astronaut who returns from space, and something's happened to her up there, and she can't reconnect to her husband or her young twins or life on Earth, and it's she's having an existential crisis, and she's been a successful woman, and she's 45, and so it answers questions, but it has that kind of, funnily enough, ordinary people. When I first started working on the 5,000 draft of Nexus, I told the producer that, I said, God, ordinary people keeps flashing to my head. And I think it's just, again, that quietness that Moon has at times that I would like to emulate for Nexus, to try and bring that in as well. So again, it's not a big flashy sci-fi piece. It's something that is it's a very recognisable world seen from a different lens, from my protagonist Catherine's way of looking at the world. And it's about identity too, yeah, so.
That's interesting. Mm. And this wave of, well, films, television, all of it about space travel and earthbound space travel, realistic, imaginary space travel, where we want to believe that we are better at this than we currently are as a species, and we're just a couple of years behind where the movies are taking us. Is there, I mean, Moon was 10 years ago. Astronaut is current. There's a film called Red Rover with Christian Brune and Kara G.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
It was at the Canadian Film Festival. It's quite good.
Wow.
It's the reverse of your film, actually.
What's it
called?
It's called
Red Rover, and it stars Christian, who's a friend of the podcast, yeah. And Kara is too. And in fact, most of the people in the movie are friends of the show. Christian plays an engineer who his marriage has collapsed. He's living in his own basement now, renting it while they figure out the sale of the house. And his ex-wife has taken in a new boyfriend, and he's depressed and sad and decides to volunteer for a space mission, a one-way ticket to Mars.
Wow.
So it's part of it is a reality show gambit.
Oh, it sounds fabulous.
Yeah, send in your audition. And he befriends a young woman who's handing out the flyers effectively for this promotion. Mm. And it becomes about his decision to leave everything behind, and what that would mean, and what it does to his relationships. Mm. And it's actually pretty clever. The director, Shane Belcourt, who made Toronto a few years back.
Oh, right. I'm going to remember that.
Yeah,
I'll write it down at the end.
Give you the information. And it's probably going to be opening in the fall, I think, or in the spring. But it premiered here in March at the Canadian Film Festival.
Well, it sounds really, really up my comfort, my street.
Yeah,
because there was Clara last year too,
yeah,
which I actually saw and I really enjoyed it. I didn't see it at TIFF. I saw it. I watched a link somebody sent me, but the producer sent me. But there is a real trope now. So there's a real group of films that are coming out, and all about space and return and who are we? And
it feels almost like it's been percolating somehow.
I started Nexus 5 years ago at university, 4 years ago at university. That's okay. When I started developing it. And, you know, they've got Ad Astra coming out.
Yeah.
Tons of other stuff. So, and you hope people don't grow weary of it. But because I think they're human stories, I think that there's a return to that somehow. You know, we've had the massive Avengers and the big budget, huge movies, which my husband and I all see, you know,
sure,
all the time, and they're great. But now you need something that maybe questions our place in the universe a bit more, and why are we here, and who are we, and interests me that.
Yeah, I think we've finally come back around to where we were in the late 60s, just trying to figure out, okay, we are going to the moon. What does it really mean? Does it change our perspective of humanity?
Mm.
Are we starting to think about it? Or now is it just that the Martian made it all financially viable to produce films?
Well, yeah. I mean, I love space travel. I mean, Rich Drifts and I would talk about this, and he'd say, would you go? And I went, oh, yeah, I'd go. I mean, I'm really claustrophobic, so I'd have to take a lot of drugs to go or something.
Right, yes.
Psychiatrist strapped in next to me. But I'd go as long as I could come back. But there is something about that incredible, and especially as you get to older, as you get to my age, you sort of think, I'd like to have one look at the Earth from space, really be there and just see. I mean, I write a lot about space, so I've been there in my imagination, but
sure,
to actually been there, be there and just see how we are connected to the universe and our place really in it is it would be such a profound thing to do. But I think you have to be certainly brave to do it. I mean, Richard wants to go too. He's always wanted to go. Yeah.
Oh, that again, you know, Close Encounters, right? You're just dealing with that. You say that, and my first thought is the flash of him looking up.
Yeah, yeah.
As a younger man 4 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And my, I tried to explain it to somebody once, and it's like, it would be like meeting a dragon. It's probably going to kill you. But, you know, you get to meet a dragon.
Yeah, you get to meet a dragon.
I could see myself doing this, the space travel with the same idea that, you know, there are horrific risks. And yet we all want it.
Yeah.
A few people probably don't, but I think I would like to think most of us would be up for it.
I think it's an exciting, it's a very exciting concept too. And you know, you hear physicists and people talking about it. And a friend of mine's brilliant. He did all the research for the film on Astronaut because it may not show, but my God, we researched every single thing. We researched the composition of roads and the likelihood of a runway collapsing. And it's phenomenal when people say, I didn't really believe. And I go, are you kidding me? I mean, you know, I did research. I had a blowout on a drive I was doing. And it was the third tire that had exploded on a motorway home. And I said to the guy that came out, I said, what's going on? He said, these roads aren't what they used to be, love. He said, they're not made the same way. So I thought, that's what Angus can do. He can be a civil engineer. So I called up a big, big major road company. I mean, very famous, won't mention them. And I said, look, could this ever happen? Could? And he said, well, it's unlikely. But actually, funny enough, he reminded me of something that we were all flown out to the United Arab Emirates quite recently because they had spent millions on laying a racetrack, a motorway, you know, run for cars.
Right.
And on their first trial, all the cars slid off because they had laid it with a certain type of limestone that was completely wrong.
For the environment?
Mm.
Oh, okay.
And they slipped off. And I thought, yeah, it's plausible. Yeah, I believe that. Yeah, okay, well, that's fine. We'll go. So, you know, there are always mistakes, aren't there? I don't know how I got onto that, but
I think it's part of our exploration as a species is that we're constantly chasing the new thing and forgetting the old thing.
Yeah.
There was some viral thing the other day on Twitter about, do you remember this? And it's like, yeah, that's a video cassette, or that's maybe it was an audio cassette, but it was just something, yes, of course I remember this. I'm not 20.
Yeah, yeah.
And the 20-year-olds are, oh, and it was the Robert Redford thing. Like the idea that we're catering to these short blip memories, and it's not the kids' fault.
Yeah,
they don't know
anything. Yeah.
They just don't have the breadth of experience. And then you realize, oh, that's right, I'm the guy now saying, well, if you knew these things, if you were as my age and you'd pay attention.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's cruel, but, you know, that's what books are for.
Yeah, I know, but I've got a 24-year-old daughter, so, you know, it's, I know. But actually, my brother worked for a very well-known Canadian bank for 30 years. He was the head of PR, public relations, and he told me when I was writing this, I said, oh, Rob, I need some help here. He lives in Canada. And I said, and he said, well, funnily enough, when the millennium happened, we had to call all the old guys in because in case there was a crash.
Right,
because
sure.
In case the computers crashed.
Because they'd know
and
the
they
systems.
Were the only ones that knew how to fix it.
Yeah.
So, of course, went straight into the film. You know, I just use that as an example of Angus fighting his corner. But it was true. And, you know, all the young bots were going, what happens? What happens? What do we do? So I think, you know, the elderly are really marginalized and should be absolutely seen and heard.
Yeah. I mean, I assume by the time I'm old enough to worry about this stuff, they'll just incinerate me the way they do the Sam Bell clones. But it would be nice if there was something to do when I'm 80 instead of just be a briquette.
Yeah, yeah. I can't imagine just ever not having the amount of energy I've got and wanting to be involved because... yeah, but I mean, you know, it's funny because I go into shops now and people say things like, oh, my mother's like that. And I'm dreading the day when they say, oh, my grandmother's like that. But, you know, then I can go around spreading my wisdom. Right?
Exactly. You'll be more
if I've learned anything at all.
Yeah. Yeah. You just, you know, shout it at them.
Yeah.
My thanks to Sheila McLeod, whose debut feature Astronaut is playing in Toronto and Vancouver right now and available for rental and purchase on iTunes and Google Play Music. Thanks also to Robin Mogul. She knows what she did. You can find Sheila on Twitter at Sheila McLeod, all one word, and you can find Moon on Blu-ray, DVD, and a new 10th anniversary 4K release from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play, and streaming in the US on Fandor and Crackle, and in Canada on Amazon Prime. As for those other movies we were just talking about, Red Rover is still awaiting a theatrical release, but you can find Clara on iTunes and Google Play right now, and you should check out writer-director Akash Sherman's Semcast on the entire Star Wars saga. He's a friend of the show, too. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you enjoy the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening, and check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. There's a lot of them. They're pretty good. See you next week.
I'm afraid you're just too darn.